Boag World is brought to you by headscape.co.uk in association with getsignoff.com. On this week's show, Ed Merritt joins us to discuss fluid, elastic layouts, and we take a look at PHP Designer, a feature-rich code editor.
Hi, Paul. How are you doing?
Hi, Paul. How are you?
Hello, Paul.
Hi, Paul.
Hi, Paul and Marcus.
Hello, and welcome to the first ever BoagWorld.com podcast.
Boag World.
Hello, welcome to the 100th episode of Boag World.
Hello and welcome to the 119th episode of BoagWorld.com, the podcast for those involved in designing, developing and running websites on a daily basis. My name's Paul Bragg, and joining me is the delectable Marcus Lillington.
Absolutely. That's a really good descriptor of me.
A descriptor?
I made that up.
Yes, it's a good word. I like it.
Yeah.
So
I think that is a real word, actually, but I got a little bit nervous about whether I thought it was a real word.
So you had a little panic.
Yeah.
Do we need to look it up? Somebody in the chat room, because we now broadcast this live.
Descriptor.
Look up descriptor?
Yeah.
Yeah, look up descriptor and find out whether it's a real world word.
Real word.
So I'm pissed off today.
Yes.
I'm in a grumpy mood.
All the time at the moment.
I've been made by the world at large to feel like a second-class citizen, and I will have it no longer.
Why?
Because, right, we basically, you know, back in the Roman Empire, okay, there is a link.
I'm old, here, but not that old, yes.
That if you were a citizen of the Roman Empire, you had all these extra rights that nobody else had and access to all this stuff,
yeah.
Okay? Just like it today with Americans, right? Americans get all this stuff that I don't get, and I'm annoyed about it.
Like what?
Right. So I listen to the Twit podcast, okay? And on the Twit podcast, it basically, their sponsor is Audible.com that do audiobooks.
Yeah, yeah.
148,000 titles, all very exciting, right? So I go along and I sign up to Audible.com, okay? Except it sneakily, in the sign-off process, reroutes me to Audible.co.uk, right? Fair enough, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care whether I'm quite proud of our .co.uk domain, even though it's longer than all the others and really annoying. So I sign up and I pay my £7 a month for audiobooks. Three titles on audible.co.uk. That's it.
Three.
It's like they've got nowhere near as many.
Well, what was it, 148,000?
148,000.
Three.
Yeah.
I hope you got your money back.
I might be making up some of those numbers, but the principle still stands.
I see. Right, 148,000, 96,000 is probably closer to it.
Maybe.
Yes.
But look, let me give you an example, right?
Okay.
I wanted to download the Screwtape Letters, okay?
Which, I don't know those.
No. It's written by C.S. Lewis.
Oh, right, yeah.
English author, right? English author.
Old as well, been around for a long time.
Yeah, well-established, famous English author, okay? Also, it was narrated by John Cleese.
Right.
Superb English comedian.
Mm-hmm.
And English author, English comedian. Audible.co.uk didn't have it. Audible.com has it. Bloody unfair it is. So there you go.
That's a pretty weak though, Paul, actually. I thought it was going to be some sort of major human right we were talking about here.
Yeah,
more books.
But then I tried to buy a backpack and I couldn't do that because they didn't do international shipping. It's supposed to be the World Wide Web, for crying out loud.
Well, you can't ship backpacks over a telephone line.
No, I know, but if you're going to have an internet site, it should be kind of international distribution, should it not? Yeah, look, somebody in this chat room, iTunes Store, another great example. UK can't rent decent movies or TV programs.
Mm-hmm.
It's crap. So there we go. That's really right. And what do we have in England instead? The Eurovision Song Contest.
Well, we don't have that. We have no part in that.
And how bitter are we about that over here?
Not at all. I hated it for years.
So the Eurovision Song Contest, for our American listeners.
Lots of rain. You're not wrong there.
So, yes, the Eurovision Song Contest. Explain the Eurovision Song Contest to American listeners and stop commenting on the chat room that nobody else can see.
Ah, right. Okay, sorry. Yes, that was a very highly rude of me.
It was.
To the podcast listener.
Yes.
The Eurovision Song Contest, it's a song contest between countries.
Supposedly in Europe, except Israel is in it.
Yeah, well, that's always been the weird one. Everything else is European, I
think. Wow, some of them are pretty, you know, how far does Europe stretch across the old Soviet Republic?
Yeah, but basically it's become a political voting tool type
yes.
of thing. Basically, all the countries vote on all the other songs, and they're all dreadful pop songs. Really awful.
It has been
for years.
I obviously think that you should go for it. I think it'd be great
it's
Eurovision
utter,
entry.
Utter crap. Always has been. But now what happens is all the little tiny ex-Russian republics all vote for each other.
Yeah, and all the Baltic republics.
So basically, if you're a Western European country like France, Germany,
England.
Italy, England, no chance.
Well,
at all.
We could win if we all voted for one another, but as all the Western European countries hate one another...
Well, there aren't enough, it still wouldn't happen because there aren't enough of us.
No, that's true. We need
but
to,
I don't care. I mean, hopefully it means that it will die a very quick death. I was going to say long...
And they took off Doctor Who for it, so I'm appalled. So we might be slightly bitter simply because we came last this year.
Did we?
Yeah.
I don't care. I really watched it
for the first time, and it was made enjoyable, not because of the TV programme, not even because of Terry Wogan's excellent commentary of it, but simply because Twitter was a hoot. Everybody was slagging it off over Twitter, so that was fun. Anyway, has this got anything to do with web design?
I don't think so.
Why did you bring it up then?
You brought it up.
Oh, yeah. So let's move on to...
I was going to do a Terry Wogan impression, but I can't do it at the moment.
That wasn't a particular
one. I need to do some smoking and stuff like that, then I can do Terry.
Okay. So let's move on into...
And drinking, of course, because he gets gradually more drunk over... Oh, I'm not allowed to interrupt you, am I?
No, nope, you're not. You got told off for that last year. Last year? Last week.
Dear.
It's been a long week.
So, yeah, I'm going to sit here quietly because I've never got anything to add. So.
Apparently. Well, you were a bit over the top last week. You were interrupting more than normal.
I know. I
couldn't get through the news stories.
Remarkably happy and jolly last. I won't interrupt you this week because I feel miserable.
Okay, that's good. So let's move on to the miserable news.
World of Boag. World of Boag. World of Boag.
So I'm a bit of a dedicated follower of fashion, don't you know?
Well, and you are, actually. That's quite true. You always have some sort of trendy new pair of trainers that I
trainers?
Normally giggle at. Or
trainers? I've had the same pair of shoes for about 10 years.
Well, you know, just the first word that came out of my mouth. That's
yeah.
all that was.
If you said gadget, then you would have probably been right.
No, you have trendy clothes as well, hats and stuff.
Don't start on me.
It's true, though.
Don't start on me.
You started it.
So, basically, one of the ways that I follow fashion... is with design trends. I like following design trends on the web, which is probably why I like Patrick McNeil's Design Meltdown so much, and the kind of stuff that he follows there. And one trend that has currently caught my eye is, you know, how very obviously everybody seems to be moving away from web 2.0 kind of looks to something a bit more ornate and flowery and, you know, attractive. And this style, I think I'm going to term frilly bits. It's sites that have frilly bits.
Design you can't do.
Do you know? Yeah. Yeah, kind of lots of like ornate curls. Like you'd get on old kind of furniture and architecture and stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know the kind of thing, the swirls and ornaments. You get them in old typefaces as well.
Mm.
You know, if you know, you get the main letters, obviously A to Z and all the numbers and stuff, but then they also do these little kind of leafy, curly things and stuff like that.
There's a proper name for those.
Yeah, I know.
I can't remember what it is.
No, neither can I.
Someone will tell us.
Yeah, I'm sure. And then we probably won't be able to pronounce it properly and we'll look stupid. So they've been around for years. They've been used by blacksmiths and typesetters and all kinds of, you know, oldie worldy people.
Mm.
But they also turn up on things like wedding invitations.
Ah, yes, classic.
Ornaments. There we go. Someone reckons it's ornaments.
Could be.
I quite like the idea of ornaments. Let's call it ornaments. Although frilly bits is quite nice too. So yeah, they're now starting to appear on the web. And I think probably one of the first sites I saw them on was Cameron Mole's blog, who is an amazing designer with a kind of very ornate and delicate style, about as far away from mine as is physically
yes.
possible to be, I believe, in the sledgehammer approach to design. So recently one of Cameron's readers asked him where he sourced all the beautiful ornaments.
Oh, yes.
I wrote it down myself. And he's been kind enough to share with us 25 different sources for similar frippery.
Nice.
Frippery is a good word.
That is a good word, yes.
We don't use frippery enough in the English language. Unfortunately, simply knowing...
It's like slippery.
except with an F.
With an F and an R. Otherwise, that would be Srippery, wouldn't it?
Yes. Okay, stop it now. See, this is what people were complaining about last week. Unfortunately, simply knowing Cameron's sources will not grant us the ability to design as well as him. However, it's an extremely useful list that's definitely worth perusing, which is another cool word, at your leisure. So, second news story. So returning from the world of creativity, I guess, to the reality of project management. It's a bit of a come down, isn't it? Our next post tackles the frustrating subjects of clients failing to deliver content on time. We've never had that ever. All our clients are so good and always deliver immediately when we ask them to.
I can't remember one that didn't deliver on time.
Oh, you're talking crap. That's because after you've sold the project, you walk away and don't care what happens next.
I so wish that was true.
So anyway, our next post tackles that subject, and it's entitled The Cure for Content Delay Syndrome, which I think is a good title.
The main reason for content delay is that most clients don't realise the extent of the job. Well, then they start doing it. I mean, it's normal because they start doing it thinking, I don't like this, I want to change it. And that wasn't part of their original planning.
Yeah.
So
basically, the article is addressing the subject of copywriting again, you know, which I think we've talked about quite a lot in the past. We've had the problem of it's all well and good thinking, yes, we need someone to copyright, but persuading clients of that is an entirely different matter, isn't it? And we've kind of struggled to do that to some degree.
I almost think, I think we're to blame as well, because I think it's absolutely right that we should have a copywriter on board here that works for us, who champions writing good web content, and we sell that as part of the package. And I think until we get that person, we won't sell it as part of the package. I know we could bring in... stop looking at me like that.
What?
That was a television... What do they call it? You know, when the newsreader's done the interview.
Does the nod.
And the nodding afterwards.
The nodding, yes. And the ums afterwards. Yeah, I know what you mean.
Sorry, I'm just sitting. I mustn't look at you. Right, okay. I can't remember the point I was making.
I don't know. Something about it's our fault and that we should have a copywriter.
Until we get a copywriter on board, I don't think we're going to do that. The more we've pushed information architecture work, requirements capture, stakeholder interviews, all those kind of things that we used to talk a lot about doing when it was just web design that we did. We do that more than web design now, I would say.
Yeah.
That's an exaggeration.
Yes, it is, but it's a good exaggeration.
We do too much of it.
Yes.
He complained.
Only because we have to do it. But, I mean, I think... Well, what I find quite interesting about this article is he kind of suggests that actually it's not a copywriter you need.
Okay.
Which is quite interesting. Yeah, because the problem is that many clients believe they can write their own copy. And they're kind of, to some extent, that's almost justified. I mean, they're the experts in their field. They know their audience. And I wish you wouldn't do that, throwing the bit of paper and making purposeful noise on the podcast. You know, and some argue that it would actually take as long to brief somebody about how to write it than it would to write it themselves. And I kind of understand where they're coming from, and when budgets are tight, that sounds like a convincing argument, and in some ways it's quite hard to argue against. So this post suggests that actually you don't need a copywriter, what you need is a copy editor, and that actually there's a difference, as an editor refines clients' text rather than writes it from scratch, and as a result that's considerably cheaper because, you know, you're not starting from scratch. But also can provide a lot of the benefits of continuity, accessibility, usability, search engine optimization benefits, that kind of stuff. And what's more is the client no longer needs to worry about the quality of what he's writing, so he can concentrate on bashing it out and let the editor kind of sort it out and improve it later.
That's what I meant anyway. I think that's that. You can't, as a copywriter for, I don't know, a firm that sells software.
Yeah.
Really kind of niche market stuff. They would still have to get the content, the actual, you know, the building blocks of the content from the client and then write the copy. And surely that's content editing.
Yes. I think that's the differentiation this article is making, which I think is a great argument. And I think we ought to be pushing it more, Marcus. Make it happen.
I have actually done that before. I've sold content editing.
Yeah.
But I actually think that's what we mean anyway.
Okay. Not so that was a relevant story for us.
Yeah, completely irrelevant. Yeah. Try harder.
But other people are interested, so that's fine, because not everybody's as enlightened as you, Marcus. Okay, so from the role of editor to the many roles of the budding web entrepreneur.
Ooh, blimey.
That sounds posh, doesn't it? We haven't spoken very much about developing web applications on the show, which is definitely, I think, something that we probably need to look at.
It's a bit dim, really, since that's what we're doing.
I know, but you kind of, in some ways you feel, well, it's not traditional web design because traditional web design has been service industry, and that's, for the vast majority of people, is still very much the case. However, there is a kind of growing number of people that are looking at adding products to their, you know, their lineup of offerings, and some even that are making the switch entirely. Some companies that are making the switch from kind of producing websites for other people to producing it for themselves. And certainly, as you said, that's something we're doing ourselves with GetSignOff.com. So, what does it take to be a web entrepreneur and build web applications? Well, unless you've got a lot of venture capital, it requires you to wear a lot of hats. And that's what's explained in this post that I came across on the Think Vitamin site. And
plug.
Basically, someone in the chat room has just accused us of plugging GetSignOff. GetSignOff.com. So from marketeers to customer service representatives, you're required to fulfill many of the roles that kind of you associate with different people.
Just wait till it goes live, then you'll see plugging.
Yeah, you haven't seen anything yet. What was that URL again, someone's asking, if you could provide it the URL?
That's get, G-E-T.
I think they can probably spell getsignoff.com.
What was that, sorry?
That was getsignoff.com.
Okay.
I feel like the Silip Bang man, because he says Silip Bang about 20 times in his adverts. Right, it's a challenging undertaking. I've lost it now completely. So this is the, I've got, you know, not only have I got you harassing me now in news stories, I've got the whole chat room. So it is a massive undertaking, being a kind of web entrepreneur, and you do have to do a lot of different jobs. But get it right and you have regular income coming into your company without the overheads associated with a service-based business. So if you are thinking about doing it, check out this article on Think Vitamin. It is extremely good. Intranets is another subject that we haven't looked at very much on the show, which is strange because they continue to grow in importance and yet have fundamentally unresolved problems that it seems like every intranet seems to be suffering from. So this week sees two great posts from Jerry McGovern exposing these flaws, including the tendency of intranets to become dumping grounds for information and also for their lack of decent search. And both posts in their own way focus on the fact that intranets should be about getting things done, a great passionate phrase of mine, and they should provide tangible productivity benefits. But let's face it, most intranets don't do that. And each post kind of identifies its own reasons for this being the case. So the first point is the way intranets are perceived, that many see them as an information repository, which is basically, as far as I can gather it, a fancy way of saying where information goes to die. Viewing an intranet in this way, McGovern argues, is missing the point. We should only be distributing information if it actually aids productivity and encourages collaboration. The second post argues that the intranets fail to be to aid productivity because the information is just downright hard to find. And in particular, Jerry targets search, but he also argues there's a wider problem of findability. Why is it, he asks, that even on, in the largest of organizations, nobody's dedicated to ensuring that employees can quickly and easily find information to do their jobs? So if you run an intranet, if you're involved in designing intranets for clients, then check out this post or both of these posts. They are excellent reads and are available in our show notes at boagworld.com/podcast/119. Okay, I think that about wraps that up, and let's now move on to our feature for the day.
World of Boag. World of Boag.
Ed Merritt, who is one of our designers at Headscope. Hello, Ed.
Hello.
It's really good to have you on the show.
It's very nice to be here.
You haven't been on the show before, have you?
I haven't, no.
Oh, it's the first time for everything. I'm sure we will get you back.
There might be a reason, we'll find out.
Oh, it's going to be like that, is it?
It could be. It's one of those days.
So, basically, I wanted to give some of the other people in Headscope the chance to contribute as well. Not just to the show, but to the blog and stuff like that, because I've quickly come to realise that there are a lot cleverer people in Headscape than me, which was a hard thing for me to realise and it was most distressing.
It's always been the case, Paul.
And I've had to have therapy, but I've come to the assumption that actually there are a lot cleverer people. Also, see, Ed is hands-on designer day in and day out, actually coding CSS.
That's true.
Well, I just talk about it, don't I, really?
You do.
So we're going to get Ed talking about it as well. And the kind of subject that we wanted to talk about was this idea of the different types of layout that are available, whether it be fluid, fixed, you know, whatever. So, Ed, how about you kick us off and just talk us through the different kind of options that have traditionally been available and perhaps some of the pros and cons of each of them.
Okay. Obviously, there's fixed width is by far the most common because it's the easiest to build by a long way, as I'm discovering. Fixed width basically means you fix everything to a fixed pixel width, and you usually have a fixed column structure within that. Nothing moves too much. Trouble with that is if you blow the text size up, obviously your line length reduces and it all comes a bit hard to read.
Okay. I guess a lot of people kind of work around that problem by just fixing the pixel size as well.
Yeah, yeah, probably actually fixed pixel text sizes.
Yeah. But so there are situations where you think that using a fixed width design is a good approach, or do you just tend to avoid it full stop?
It's a hard one. It depends on time, mainly.
That's a very honest answer.
If I have to, then yeah, they do work well.
I guess as well, if you've got a lot of imagery that's of a fixed size, you know, that obviously you can't scale an image.
Yeah, so. Sure, you end up with a lot of space around them if you go for a scaling one.
I mean, that's where, for example, with, I'm going to say it again, getsignoff.com, because it's all built around a screenshot, and, you know, that screenshot's always of a consistent size, then it makes, I guess, sense in that kind of
situation.
That's
true, yeah, I mean, when you know the content like that, it's fine to go.
Yeah, okay. So there's fixed, what else is there?
Fluid was the second option that people kind of discovered, where everything expands to whatever space is available in your browser window, which is good, but trickier to build, but worth the time. Again, not so good for heavy image-based sites.
Okay, because you end up with the space around it and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So why... Yeah, go on.
I want to jump in at this point. I don't like fluid sites at all, because I tend to... Because I've got good eyes... I tend to have ridiculously large resolutions, and basically a fluid site. And I also like to open windows to full size, so you end up with like sites that are, you know, that I was pushing my hands apart there for the listener. fixed sites kind of can often look daft because there's just a huge amount of nothing to the right hand side or left hand side or whatever.
Yeah,
and elastic sites. Fluid sites become unreadable because it's like a paragraph turns into one sentence or one line.
Yeah, but surely it's good in the sense that with fluid sites, you're putting the user entirely in control of their own destiny.
Yeah.
So,
I was going to make a dreadful assumption there. I think some people don't realise that they can have different size windows. They just instantly open up full screen on everything.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's probably...
I've seen that. I've done lots of usability testing, and people just automatically go for the full screen.
I guess particularly under Windows, where it kind of maximises itself almost by default. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a fair comment.
No, I run mine the same, and if people haven't used a max width on a fluid site, then the line length gets ridiculously long instead.
Yeah.
And just as hard to read.
So you mentioned max width there. Mm-hmm. Talk us through... I know that for some people listening to this is very basic stuff, but, you know, we also have people that are website owners listening to this and other people that are just starting out in web design. So explain what max width is.
Max width basically is what you use on a fluid site just to cap the width at a certain point and say, be fluid up to 100% until you get to, I don't know, 1,200 pixels.
And then don't get any larger.
And then stop, yeah.
Right. So the problem surely with, or always used to be with max width, that browser support was a bit dodge for it. Are we past that problem now?
Yeah, I think so. Nearly. Nearly.
Well enough.
Yeah.
So you don't have to do any fancy coding like you used to have to
only
do
in 0.6.
All right. And you're pretending to ignore that.
I'm wishing I could ignore that. It's just a copy and paste job now.
I guess to some degree, you could, as I6 goes down, you could argue, well, they're going to have the long line length then.
Yeah.
You know, that's the worst.
It's not a terrible option.
No.
If they have an older browser, they possibly have a smaller screen as well. So.
I'm looking. Just imagine a time. This is from the chat room here. Just imagine a time when where IE6 is gone.
Bliss.
Well, it's a subject we need to discuss in this very podcast.
Well, it's a subject we need to discuss internally about how we're going to deal with the demise of IE6. Because it will go away eventually. We need to. I don't even know what the. Has anybody in the chat room got any idea of what the figures are?
It's still fairly heavy.
It's still fairly heavy, is it, IE6? I haven't looked recently, I have to say. So, so there's Fluid. What else is there?
Elastic was kind of a late arrival on the scene, but basically you fix the size as if you were doing it with pixels, but you do it with a scalable unit like M's.
Okay. Does that mean in practice?
In practice, it means it looks like a fixed width site, mm-hmm. but if you change the text size, the surrounding structure grows with the text.
Okay.
So it's all relative to the
text. So basically it all expands out at the same time. Okay. Just flipping back to Fluid, I've just thought of something else. Have you had a chance to play with the IE8 beta yet?
Not for any length of time.
Okay. Because one thing I was wondering, and I don't know, I haven't tried it, but I remember with this new zoom function that IE7 has got built into it, that if you had a Fluid site that was filling the whole width and you zoomed, you immediately got horizontal scrolling.
Yeah.
Is that still a problem as far as you're aware?
As far as I know, yeah.
Yeah, that's not good, is it, really?
It's not ideal.
We need to see what IE8 does about that, because that would be quite interesting. Someone in the chat room is quoting the statistics on the W3 school sites. I'm always very dubious about those sites, those statistics, whether they're a little bit heavy on the tech side, that, you know, 28% of people using IE6, I have trouble believing.
That's not heavy on the tech side, though, is it?
Yeah, it is.
It's quite the opposite.
No, because that's a very low number. I think that number's much lower than
that's just IE6. You've got IE7 and Firefox as well.
Yeah, but...
And IE5.
You're misunderstanding entirely. Shush.
No, I'm not.
You are.
You're wrong.
No. 28% of people are using IE... I can't believe we're having this argument.
28 one in three people, near as damn it, use IE6.
And I would expect it to be much higher than that, using IE6.
No way.
Ah, but it is.
Because IE7's been a hard download now. And all new machines go out.
I'm still not committed. I think that figure's low. What do you think?
Ed,
you can be the deciding vote. No pressure, Ed, but remember to agree with me.
Last I heard, it was about 35, so I'm quite surprised it's that low, actually.
Thank you.
Sorry, Marcus.
Right, yes. So we've done the three main ones. Okay.
Yeah.
So what we haven't done with Elastic is what are the pros and cons of doing Elastic?
The pros of Elastic are... that your line length is always readable. You don't get the problem with enlarging text size. Mm-hmm. Where in fixed browsers, fixed width layouts, line lengths obviously get really short, really quick.
Because everything's scaling consistently.
Yeah.
Okay.
So
what are the downsides?
The downsides are if your screen size can't cope with that,
it tends to go
off the side, or in better browsers, it stops and just doesn't go off the side. I think Firefox stops it.
Okay, that's pretty good.
IE doesn't.
No. So, again, you have the same problem with images, which aren't scaling. So, you know, as you go up in size, it begins
You've
to look
got
weird.
Clever techies like we have, you can get them to set them as background images on divs and then put big images in there.
Yeah, but you have to oversize the images, basically.
Okay,
so that's the three kind of staple different layout approaches. And then you wrote me this blog post about a technique that, to be honest, I'd never come across or never heard, which you're calling Fluid Elastic. Tell us a bit about that.
It's basically just a fluid width site capped with a max width, like we talked about earlier. Mm-hmm. But rather than capping it in a pixel width, do it in a scalable M's width instead.
Right. So the result of which is that it will naturally expand as a fluid site would up to a set width.
Yeah.
And then if people start zooming, it would then, you know, if they start increasing the text size, basically everything will carry on expanding out.
Yeah, so it keeps
That's
growing with
That's a good solution. Why are you so attracted towards it?
Mainly because... given the old three options, my favourite was always Elastic.
Right.
It seems to give you the best control. The only problem with it was catering for the lowest common denominator would be 800 by 600.
Right.
Which meant the width of your sites was still narrow.
Right. Well, this kind of gets around that because it's scalable.
It's just fluid.
No, it's good.
Down to that level, yeah.
So what, is it a pain to build? Is it easy to build?
It's tricky only because I'd avoided building fluid sites. I'm reminding myself how to do that. But no, there's nothing too technical about it. It's just a fluid site with a max width.
And I guess, so in effect, as long as all the dimensions are set is percentage values, except for the outside container, which has got this max width thing, then you're building as normal pretty much.
Oh, okay. Text sizes aren't in pixels.
Yes, of course. Yeah, you're going to need to avoid that.
Always
so, I mean, all the code for how to do this, you've included in your blog post, haven't you?
Yep.
Which you can get to from the show notes at bioagworld.com/podcast119/119 even. There we go. He's holding it up for the video, which isn't a lot of use. That would have to be a very high resolution camera to be able to see that, Marcus. Okay, so that sounds really good. One other question, which somebody asked on the comments, didn't they? Which is all this irrelevant anyway, considering almost all the new browsers support Zoom?
It is an interesting question because, once we get to Firefox 3, IE7 already zooms, the new Safari apparently is going to zoom. It might render it useless.
So what do you think is going to happen with design? Do you think we're all going to go back to fixed width?
We could. It would be really easy. I don't know. I'm kind of the opinion that we used to have control over this, how things scaled, and now we don't. The browser makers have just taken that away.
Yeah.
And from my point of view, I'd rather have the control.
Right.
The other, as I mentioned earlier about your average user, do they even know that they can zoom it?
Well, they do make it pretty obvious in the interface. Mm. I mean, IE7 has got this big zoom bar down the bottom.
Yeah, that's true.
And they're going to know that in the same way as they know how to scale text. In fact, text is hidden away quite badly in menus.
Yeah, true.
So, I think... I mean, someone in the chat room, Gary in the chat room, has just said that Zoom equals lazy design and development, but I don't know whether I agree. I think...
I don't know. There's a strong vote for consistency if all these sites were the same, even ones that haven't been so well built.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's probably better for users.
As long as, obviously, the browser implementation of Zoom works in the same way.
IE7s could be improved. But
I mean, it gets around this problem of images which don't scale.
It does, although they look terrible as soon as you zoom in.
Well, I'm sure they do, yeah. But at least, it doesn't break the layout as such.
No, that's true.
Interesting. Interesting conversation. Thank you very much, Ed, for coming on the show.
No problem at all.
And no doubt we will have you back on for more CSS wizardry in the future.
World of Boag. World of Boag. World of Boag.
Hi, Paul and Marcus. Thanks, first of all, for Boag World. I'm completely addicted to it. It's great to hear like-minded people just having a chat. My name's Simon. I run a web design business over in Watford, just up from London. And when I first started out, I really needed some software which would allow me to code in PHP, CSS, and so on, but do it easily and with shortcuts and with whatever else came along with the territory. I tried out a huge number of software. Money was really not an object. I needed something which was going to work from the word go and would just see me right the way through to whenever. Now, after a great deal of searching and a great deal of money spent on different bits of software, so I could give them all a decent go and find out what's the best one I came across was from a Danish company called mpsoftware.dk, and they released a program called PHP Designer. Now, PHP Designer has all of your usual color coding features. It's got PHP, CSS, HTML, Perl, XML, JavaScript, and everything else in the middle. And next to that, it's got buttons to tidy them up on the fly. You know how hard it is to keep your code tidy right the way through from start to finish? Well, now you've just got a button that does it for you. You don't even have to worry about keeping it tidy. So it makes that easier. So when you're passing projects over to different people, it's all formatted in exactly the same way every time. The other features I find most useful are, bracket matching. They've got a code explorer, so you can jump to functions, variables, arrays, anything else you've got in that particular page. There's a code snippet library, so you can store your most commonly used functions from project to project, and that supports PHP, JavaScript, HTML, and all the rest of them. It also validates your syntax on the fly. So as you're typing lines, if you pause for long enough, it might highlight the line in red if there's a PHP error, which saves a lot of flicking between windows and refreshing the page to see where these errors are and make sure you've got everything out of the way. If you forget how the syntax of a particular function, it's got a little tooltip that pops up. Again, if you pause for long enough, all these things just start to take effect and say, oh, you've hesitated, here's some help. If you forget completely how a function works, you can always right-click it and click View Manual, and it will open up a window within its page and have a page from php.net with the full information about that function. So it's all integrated very, very well. There's also a built-in FTP client, but it will also link to FileZilla or another FTP client if you'd rather use your own program to manage your accounts. Now, I've seen all these features before. I've seen them in Zend, and I've seen them in a lot of the other software, but the absolute best thing, the real clincher for me was this software is just so stable. It has never crashed. It has sometimes popped up with a Windows error when it shut down on Vista, particularly if you've had your laptop in standby mode. It runs smoothly. It doesn't slow down my computer. I can have it open in the background while I'm doing other things and replying to emails, and then I can come back to it. It doesn't lock all your files into a project file like some other software does, which means I can pass the files over to another developer who would rather use Dreamweaver, who would rather use Zend. One installation of PHP Designer is €39. It's absolutely nothing. There are more discounts if you buy them in bulk. So get on there, download the free one, give it a try. If you don't like it, never use it again. If you do, definitely upgrade. I highly recommend it. So thanks again, guys, for letting me say my bit. I'm Simon Jones. I'm from Zecco Media, a web design company based in Watford, and I'm looking forward to downloading the next podcast. Goodbye.
World of Boag. World of Boag. World of Boag.
Okay, so we come now to the listener feedback section of the show, and we have two questions today. The first of which involves setting up a web design company in your spare time.
Hello, Boagwell team. My name's John, and I've got a question for you. Basically, I'm starting up my own web design company, and I think is the unusual situation of trying to do it alongside my 9-to-5 job, which has absolutely nothing to do with computers. So it's actually an engineering job, so I actually have no chance at all to work with computers in my normal job. Now, I know while trying to set up a company alongside your 9-to-5, well, obviously tiring, is a very sensible and safe way to do it. Is it actually possible? I guess is what I'm asking. Do you think it's a realistic way of setting up a company, or do you think I'd have been better going with the freelance option? It's great to have the show back after what seemed like a decade, and keep up the good work.
Good question. I like that question. But really, I think it's the only way to do it, the way that he's proposing doing it, and to start building up a client base in your spare time. And I think that's how the vast majority of freelancers begin. That's not to say that it's easy. However, I think really it's a sensible approach. If you don't do that, then your options are fairly limited. Either you kind of sit and wait for redundant and hope that you be made redundant and hope that you get a big payoff. That would be one option. So you've got a big pot of cash, but that might be a long wait. Secondly, you live off the kindness of friends and family, which is a guaranteed way of losing friends.
Yes.
Or you borrow some money from the bank, unless, of course, you're super rich and a big chunk of money behind you.
It depends. It's a funny one, really, this. If you're deciding to become, because he says, or should I have gone down the freelance route? Well, if you're going to be a freelancer, then yes, you do need to kind of do it slowly, do the work in the evening, gradually build up a client base, and then maybe turn yourself into a company. If that's what he means, then yes, that works.
Yeah.
But if you're going to sort of like try and set up a proper company, employ people, that kind of stuff, while you're still doing your 9-to-5 job, I don't think you'd do it properly. I think it would be a half-hearted.
Yeah.
It would not be the kind of company that people would want to work with, because that's your main issue. You'd have to deal by email only, or your mobile phone going off at 11:30 at night. And what client's going to want to deal with you like that?
Yeah, but you can start off by building up, you know, small clients. I think you can do in your spare time. I mean, you're thinking about the kind of massive clients we do, and nobody's going to start with that. I mean, personally, out of those options, I'm very much against borrowing money. I think, I mean, we really were against that ourselves, weren't we, when we set up Headscape?
Yeah, but for most, we were very lucky. I think most people do need to borrow some money kind of tide them over. It's like we've always talked about make sure you've got a cushion, you know, cover at least 1 month's kind of turnover, if you like. And on day one, you probably haven't got that, so you might need to borrow it.
Yeah,
it's
but
real
if you've been
stuff,
but, well, the trouble is, if you get a startup loan, then you're substantially increasing the risk, aren't you? That that you can't just walk away from this. You're kind of committed to that line of thought.
Yeah.
Well, if you can do it without getting a loan, then, you know, it means that at any stage you can just walk away and go back and get a proper job. And I think actually kind of doing some freelance work in the spare time has got a lot of benefits. One is that, you know, you're able to save some money. You know, I'm presuming you can. I mean, hopefully you can save some money anyway in your 9-to-5 job. But that extra money that you earn in the evenings, you can set aside to be that cushion for when you start off.
Save money. Sorry, I don't understand.
Yeah,
that.
I know. I know it's a very foreign concept to you. And secondly, also, hopefully that some of those clients you get in the evening become regular clients. So when you set up, you've already got regular work there. I mean, that's what happened with Headscape. Okay, we stole the clients from the previous company that was going under.
So
had
we didn't
gone under.
Steal them. It went under.
Yeah, I know. Or we rescued them, however yes. you want to put it. But basically, that meant that we had regular income from day one.
Yeah, and that's what I was saying. We were very lucky. And I think that... I don't know, if we hadn't had such good clients to kick us off, we might have been in a position where we may have needed to get some funding to tide us over for 6 months. Yeah, it does make it that much
more serious. Yeah, no, I would agree. But that's only because we suddenly had to make the decision to go freelance. If we were able to go independent, if we were able to build up some clients part-time in the evening and that kind of thing, then I think that would have been a good enough foundation not to make it 100% safe. It's never going to be 100% safe, but at least to give you a bit of a cushion and a bit of a starting point. That's all I'm getting at.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I don't agree with that.
Okay.
I think that you've got to kind of jump in properly, otherwise you won't take it seriously, is kind of where I'm, my view on this one.
Okay. Then I will refer to your view, honestly.
I'm not saying it's right.
So
let's
move on. We agree to differ.
Hello, Paul and Marcus. My name is Robert Pryor, and I am from Waco, Texas. I am currently a beginner web designer, but in the future I would like to set up a small web design agency here where I live. And my question is, when you're trying to get that URL for your company name, how important is it to go after the different extensions like .net, .info, .tv? Are those important at all, or do you just need to get the one main one like the .com name? Really enjoy the show and appreciate all the hard work you guys put into it, and look forward to future episodes. Thank you.
In my opinion, domain names are really, 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 really important. Really important. And you should definitely try to get the domain name that's the extension of your country, so .fr, .co.uk, whatever, but also try and get the .com as well. Now, we've never managed to do that, have we, with Headscape? We did contact the people that have got the .com version, and they wanted to charge us bajillions of dollars.
A million? No, it wasn't. I can't remember what it was. It was tens of thousands of dollars.
I think it was $30,000.
Yeah.
Which, yeah, and because the vast majority of our clients are in the UK, .co.uk has been perfectly adequate for our needs. But if you can get .com, then you should do so as well. However, a good domain is about a lot more than just what extension you have. Personally, I'm not a fan of these new Web 2.0 URLs like Flickr and del.icio.us, otherwise known as Delicious, or dig, you know, they're hard to spell and they're hard to remember. In my opinion, a good URL should be a well-known word or words, even if not directly associated with your product. So Headscape is a great example of that. It sounds more like a hairdresser's than it does a web design agency, but at least it's memorable and easy to spell. Another common mistake is to go for a domain name with hyphens in it. This never works very well, as you have to say to somebody, check out my website at headscape.co.uk. No, it's just there. It's a mouthful, isn't it?
I know what you mean, but the hyphens aren't, I don't think, as bad as you make out, because they do separate out the words. If you've got kind of, particularly if you've got one of those company names that if you put them, join them together, they make different words.
Yeah, oh yeah.
That's kind of good to put the hyphens in then.
Of course, there are always exceptions, but generally I think hyphens aren't great.
There's the lorry company, isn't there? UK lorry haulage. Eddie Stobart.
Right.
It actually reads Eddie's Tobart on the back of their lorries.
Yeah, it's like does.
They should
right.
have put some capitals in there or hyphens. But anyway.
So, What are you laughing at?
What's on there?
What have they said on there? Yeah, we're not really reading that. Okay. Oh, yeah, we could read penisland.com.
Exactly.
A good example of where a hyphen might not go astray.
Yes.
So, the ideal domain name should also be descriptive of the site, if at all possible. Start reading these other ones. You say... Yeah, I can't repeat these. So it should be descriptive if possible. For example, we were blown away to discover the getsignoff.com domain name was available. It describes exactly what we do and is memorable too. That said, there have been recent studies that seem to indicate that a brand name, e.g. Amazon.com, is actually more valuable than a generic name like books.com. Which surprises me. So if you're forced to, you know, pick one or the other, then pick the former. Finally, be careful to avoid words that have multiple spellings, especially if you work internationally. For example, don't use a domain name like colourtheory.com because it could be spelt with a U or it could be spelt without the U. So, yeah, many claim that there aren't any good domain names left. And although it's harder these days, as Get Sign Off proved when we were still looking for that, a bit of lateral thinking... and you should be able to find a decent domain name. There are actually tools out there, which we've included in the show notes, that you could try as well, that help you find domain names.
I'm not sure. What do you think about things like .tv and .info? I'm a little bit...
To be honest, if we started doing a video podcast, .tv would be very sensible.
It would.
.info, think it's a pointless domain name, really. .net, again... It's a fallback. .org, if you're a charity or, you know, that kind of thing, then fine. But, somebody's just mentioned in the chat room, .travel. I think possibly that might work, you know, if you're a travel-related. I'm just not a great fan of them, to be honest, because people don't think of them, and they seem a bit foreign, if that makes sense.
Goes out to register.
Someone's gone to register. TV. Yeah, we really got to get that, actually.
Oops.
Oh, well, that's screwed then. Damn. Okay, so that about wraps up today's show.
It does indeed, and I don't have a joke this week.
You don't have a joke?
I haven't got one I like. Send me some more jokes, please, marcus@boagworld.com.
There we go. And you can check out everything over at boagworld.com/podcast/119. And also, don't forget to check out our forum. It's absolutely cool in there at the moment. There's some really good conversations. So check it out. Oh, so we can just wait just a second to see if we get a joke from the chat room. Oh, 10, 9,
it's not going to be
8,
read backable.
7, 6, 5, 4, 3.
Knock.
Oh, knock, knock.
Oh.
Got a great joke. England wins the Eurovision. no, that knock, knock didn't go anywhere. So there we go.
What do you call a dog with no ears?
This is really bad. This is going to be really boring for the audio.
Anything, it can't hear you.
That is absolutely terrible, Grant. We attribute that to Grant. That is, and what is it? The views expressed in the chat room in no way represent the views of BoagWorld.com. Thank you for listening, and speak to you again next week. Goodbye.
Bye.
Hello, world of Boag.
Like being on David Letterman.
Boag World! Boag World!
Or join our forum at boagworld.com/forum.